are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents and students worldwide.
That's the best part of enabling people and staff in schools to have conversations about how things are going, away from accountability, away from this sense of judgment, of actually, as you said about mistakes, of making it completely acceptable.
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources, and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance, and research-based publications.
This week, listen to Ross McGill, founder of Teacher Toolkit, interview Kat Howard, assistant principal at the Dustin School in Northampton. In today's podcast, some of the things we'll be discussing are the hallmarks of a good curriculum, the importance of operational expertise in schools, and exploring teacher well-being as more than a tokenistic phrase.
Hello everyone, this is Ross at Teacher Talk at the most influential blog on education in the UK. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Kat Howard, Assistant Principal at Dunstan School in Northampton. Good afternoon, Kat, how are you?
Hello, I'm good, thank you, Ross. Thank you for inviting me along.
No, well, the reason I've got in touch is your wonderful book, which I've got in my hand. And I know you have a second one, which I failed to pronounce correctly. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But I'm still talking about wellbeing. Let's get straight to business. Tell our listeners what this book is about in particular.
It was looking at how sometimes we might approach well-being in a little bit of a tokenistic, well-meant but tokenistic fashion in schools, and actually how we can look at the systems and creating the correct conditions for teachers to feel a sense of empowerment and feel fired up, and you know, and just a general sense of well-being about coming into work every day, but as a result of, you know, workload reduction rather than kind of one size fits all well-being strategies sometimes that we see in schools.
And it's, I particularly enjoyed it from at least the social media perception. A lot of people have really enjoyed all the strategies and all the case studies. Could you unpick maybe one of your highlights of the case studies of the people that you worked with?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a funny way that I came about the role that I'm in now, because I originally interviewed Sam, our head at Dustin, before I got the job there. So as a result of wanting to look at the way that Dustin have approached workload reduction. So one of the ways that we approach it as a whole school is we have a workload charter where we commit to staff several different systems that we actually have put into place to make sure that we are really mindful of workload. So things like making sure that we hand over a significant amount of time for CPD, because we want people to not feel isolated, and we want people to be able to have conversations around their subject and around teaching and pedagogy, because we all know that that's what, you know, keeps us really engaged and really enthusiastic about being in work. But in order for those things to take place, we need to make sure that the time is given to do so, and that we remove any barriers to that. So things like, we have email embargoes, we don't send emails at weekends or holidays, and we have a real kind of whole school approach in that. We do daily messages, which is where all of our kind of key communications are centrally collected and emailed out once a day to reduce email communication. We really encourage face-to-face conversation, and if anything, we had kind of prior to COVID had an increased meeting time, with the premise of, if you don't need the meeting, don't have it for the sake of having a meeting. But actually, people need opportunities to meet and have conversations. So those are a few examples. I talk a great deal in the book about communication generally. I think emails are the death of the conversation almost within schools. And I think that we use, and we use email in such a funny way in education, because it's not necessarily because it's the most effective way to communicate, but it's almost conversation. So I think school leaders really need to be mindful of making sure that people have opportunities to talk to one another, because that's what gets the really meaningful, gritty work done, and actually those conversations are what build relationships.
Sure. And so COVID, how's your school responded, you know, with the kind of workload well-being issues over this last 6 months?
We essentially just wiped everything anything from the calendar that wasn't absolutely necessary. So things like any external reviews or any kind of QA or any meetings that were taking place that we didn't necessarily need to have, any kind of connections to data, because we know data is in flux at the moment, and with where children are, and actually just take it back to the nuts and bolts of what do we need in order to make sure that teachers can go home as soon as the day is over, and that we put that emphasis back on CPD. So we've really kind of cleared the calendar. We used whole class feedback as an approach as a whole school institutionally anyway. So we've really put the emphasis on that and making sure that things like remote learning work, any work that's submitted via remote learning, we still continue to use the whole class feedback sheets, which really reduces. And we've also said, you know, don't take marking home, don't take marking out of the building. If you're doing whole class feedback, it should only take you 20 to 30 minutes. So, you know, don't take it home with you and let it sit in the corner of your house staring at you all weekend, or in the boot of your car thinking about it, and then, you know, bring it back to work, because we all know that's what we do with it. But I think there's so much to be learned from, and we're kind of in conversations about what can we learn from this period of time to remove systems that, you know, if we've gone this long without, we don't need anymore. And I think that's going to be the silver lining.
If I could put you on the spot, what's the one thing that your school's speculating on potentially getting rid of? If there was
not bringing back, well, we've kind of handed it over to the staff. So our plan is to, we have one-to-ones with every single member of staff in the building at two points in the year. So we've had it earlier on, but part of that conversation is how are things going in COVID? And also later on in the day, just after Christmas, we'll be putting a survey out to say, you know, what lessons have we learned? What have we taken away? Really simple things like we've got a staggered start for students coming in the morning, and we meet them all at lineups. It makes it really easy for tutors to hold students to account when it comes to uniform expectations, because you've got the presence of SLT there. And it's things like that that actually make those conversations that sometimes can be really, really time consuming as a teacher or a tutor in school, that we just, you know, have made, I think, so much easier. But part of that conversation, I think anything that you change at whole school level, It needs to have, it's that dual narrative. You need to make sure that you're including teachers at ground level that are going to be impacted by those decisions before you start looking at what you do or don't bring back. So it's probably a very roundabout way of answering your question, but it needs to be, the teachers need to be involved in that.
As you know, I've been fascinated with workload for many years. Just for context for listeners, can we just rewind, you know, give us a little insight into your leadership journey and what inspired you to become a school leader? And I guess, where did that workload issue or passion from you stem from, I suppose? So your background first.
Yeah, so I used to work in the financial sector for a number of years in the retail section of a high street bank. I was I oversaw recruitment and retention. So essentially my job was to measure how many people were coming in and how many people were leaving, because it was incredibly expensive to train people. And it was, you know, so it was really expensive if we trained them just for them to go somewhere else. So it was really about kind of how do we look after staff. I then decided to retrain as a teacher. Went back to university and then went on to do my PGCE, and then worked in a number of schools and found it really interesting that when I looked around for the people that I did my PGCE with, how many were left after about 4 years and then five years and then 6 years, and what was impacting that, and having some really kind of unfortunate conversations with colleagues and friends around toxic schools and around that kind of loss of humanity, that I think that when systems are under pressure, that's how school leaders perhaps may react as a result of pressure being projected onto them as well. And I found that really interesting, but also really frustrating, because a lot of the systems in schools didn't really seem to make sense. We have a lot of systems in schools where the left hand isn't talking to the right hand, and so you find that particularly with when you've got SLT that have got a particular agenda, so the behaviour guy or
what
girl.
Do you think that stems from? Do you think that stems from Ofsted forces, lack of finances, or lack of maybe leadership training?
Yeah, see, I've had this debate with Tom Rogers previously, who is quite happy to put it down all to Ofsted, but I don't necessarily think that's the case. I think that we could really do with learning from, and Mary Might does this very nicely as well, learning from other sectors and their experiences of how to train people in, you know, HR operations, of the art of having difficult conversations but still building relational trust.
Yeah.
So things like that are really, really important. We could do far more of that, I think, in teaching, because if you, what happens is that you become a school leader because you're really good at teaching, not yeah. necessarily because of all the other operational stuff that you also need to be really good at.
Learn on your feet, so to speak, isn't it? Make a few mistakes and hopefully yeah. not too much collateral damage. What's your, you know, including COVID, I suppose, but what do you get out of being a school leader?
I love being school leader. I think I'm really privileged because I oversee professional development, and as part of our performance management model this year, after running a pilot last year, we're now, we've got coaching as an integral part of our performance management. So we're no longer measuring outcomes or data. Staff form their own goals and then they take those goals, they own those and take those through with coaching conversations, that we protect time for those coaching conversations.
Sounds like a great school for
I find that it's fantastic, and it's fantastic to be part of that process and part of those decisions, you know. Yeah. So bringing in coaching as part of the performance management policy was really important to me, and I'm, you know, I'm very lucky that I have that autonomy. But I think that's the best part of enabling people and stuff in schools to have conversations about how things are going, away from accountability, away from this sense of judgment, of actually, as you said about mistakes, of making it completely acceptable to make mistakes.
I was going
to
ask you
because mistakes are inevitable.
Question.
Yeah, to getting better.
Is there a mistake that you've made that you know, we've all made them? What's a clanger that you've made that you regret and you hope to never repeat again?
I make mistakes every single day. I share an office with two people that could give you an insight. Yeah, every single, I think we all do that, don't we? Especially when you're managing people or you're going through change management. I think that if I look back over to, I had a role in a previous school quite early in my career of literacy coordinator. And it's that thing, as soon as you're given some sort of responsibility, I think at an early point in your career, you just want to change it all and make it all your own. And I think that would be probably the biggest mistake that I've made, is not sitting back and thinking about what's working and building on that. And sometimes I think, yeah, we're very keen to reinvent the wheel when there's plenty to be learned from. I think listening more, definitely, is something I've...
In terms, you know, COVID aside, with all the, you know, COVID aside, with all the things we're doing remotely at the moment, where was your teaching and learning strategy going at the moment? You know, the retrieval, your cognitive science aspects of learning. What are your school priorities in that regard?
Well, we've done a great deal of work on curriculum over the last 2 years and whole school curriculum. So our school improvement plan is doing the same, but even better. So every year we're building on the successes that we're building on the strengths that we have. And so it was whole school curriculum. Then we were looking at subject curriculum. So this year it was all going to be about kind of mapping across the curriculum, making sure that we've got kind of concepts mapped out, that we're revisiting information. Our classroom routines are really, really strong because we have several institutional approaches to that. So I would say that our focus now is making sure that our subject curriculum, particularly because we're an all through school, particularly at those transition points. So we've got our first lot of year six through this year, so Key Stage 2 to Key Stage 3, Key Stage 3 to 4, 4 to 5, that those transition points are really well mapped out.
No, I my son, before, you know, so the listeners will know I've left London after 30 years. My son was in an all-through state school, 3 to 18. And what I loved as a parent was seeing him being immersed with the teachers in different aspects of the key stages, and him being exposed very early to secondary school life, you know, the older kids, bigger classrooms. Is that the kind of structure you have in your own setup? I assume it is. And do your teachers mix over the key stages in some places?
Yeah, so our PE department work very closely with the primary and their primary curriculum. So we have a secondary specialist that puts the primary curriculum together and goes over and works with the primary teachers. We have our language specialist working in the primary school on a regular basis, and the music teachers, PSHE, that's all through curriculum. And so it is really nice and really beneficial. You know, I feel very privileged to be able to walk over to the primary and learn from them. Mm. And I also think, having worked in secondaries previously where you don't have that luxury, I think we can sometimes underestimate what primary school Absolutely. Children are capable of. And so seeing that is actually very eye-opening for our own teachers.
I've got a colleague at Cambridge. Sorry to interrupt you, but a colleague at Cambridge is researching all That's through right. state schools, and she's discovered that those schools don't have that year 6 to 7 transition dip for obvious reasons. So I guess there's huge benefits of having an all-through school, but your point on what you can learn from the other side, so to speak, that's something I've seen on my travels. Give me a couple of things that you have learned from the primary classroom.
Yeah, so I mean, I used to go in a previous role, I used to go regularly to moderation meetings for year six, which is, as I say, really, really eye-opening. The other piece of work that we did previously was to create a transition unit for core subjects, so that they almost do half of the unit up to the end of year six, because you have that weird dead time in between the SATs and the summer period.
Yeah, you do.
Ensure that that children remain motivated is to carry out half a unit, and then they bring that work with them up to the secondary, so it becomes this seamless act from one phase to the other. And it also enables your teachers to work collaboratively as well, that you've got secondary and primary having those conversations together to map out what that might look like.
Now you've got a new book out. I'm going to try and pronounce the name. Symbiosis. So I haven't got my hands on a copy yet. I have seen it circulated on social media. Give everyone the kind of 30-second lift pitch. What's in it?
It was a seed of an idea from Stop Talking About Wellbeing, where I wanted to talk about how important it is to teach a decent curriculum as a teacher. And so what Claire and I wanted to do is put together a handbook for leaders of curriculum, so senior leaders, subject leaders, and the classroom teacher, which I think we underestimate how much they are a contributing factor to a decent curriculum, and talk about the underpinning principles of what makes a high standard of a quality curriculum and how we go about doing that in schools.
Now, can I push you in a corner, and could you give me some of the kind of key terms or hallmarks of a good curriculum?
Yeah, I think that you need to have an understanding of knowledge structures, and you need to have an understanding of the nuances of the subject. So I can't come into a school and say, right, okay, this is what good curriculum looks like, because actually a high quality of curriculum in maths is entirely different as a hierarchical subject to a high quality curriculum in English. So the book almost acts as a guide as to, okay, how can senior leaders, if we go back to wellbeing and workload, how can senior leaders remove everything and communicate curriculum as a priority, and hand over that autonomy to subject leaders? Because you need to be an expert of the subject in order to put together a decent curriculum. But as a starting point, I think as a subject expert, you need to know your subject. Mm-hmm. You need to understand what the threshold concepts of your subject are. And then you need to understand how that kind of maps itself across a sense of progression, so that you're not repeating content, as we've sometimes seen when we've, kind of flirted with, haven't we, Key Stage 3 is 2-year, 3-year curriculum back and forth. But also that we're enabling students to re-bump into those concepts rather than just doing the same stuff over and over again.
I know of Claire. I haven't had the chance to catch up with her yet. How did you meet Claire, and how did you end up both writing a book together?
Yeah, our friendship is incredibly weird. But we met at a Team English conference very, very briefly. And then I was doing some work with, I was kind of putting together Lit Drive, very early days of Lit Drive, and asked Claire if she would like to be involved as part of the senior team to run the network side of things for our regional events. And we got to know each other from there. And so we've probably spent far more time talking over Zoom than we have actually been. real life. So we make an effort of twice a year of making sure that we go down to London and have lunch and drinks. But yeah, it was just kind of these back and forth conversations of being really interested in how lots of people know the what of the curriculum, what might be on, you know, if I'm an English teacher, what might a good English curriculum look like, but not necessarily how to go about it or how to involve a team in that process as well, and actually how empowering that can be for teachers. So yeah, an odd one.
No, really fascinating, the curriculum discussion. Now, once I pass the 20-minute mark, I then throw loads of quick-fire questions at you, so you can't pause or hesitate. And my plan is to kind of catch you out. So I'll start off easy. What project are you currently working on in school?
In school, I want to evaluate our coaching process. I want to make sure that staff feel really confident in knowing what a coaching conversation looks like. So that's my priority at the moment.
Okay, what does symbiosis mean?
Symbiosis is this interaction, so this kind of this intrinsic connection between one thing and the other. So it's making sure that we're not talking about classroom practice as detached from curriculum.
The third time I got it right. Okay, what book are you reading?
16 hours.
What book are you reading?
I am reading Evaluating Professional Development by Thomas Guskey, and I'm listening to Hammett for my book club, my very geeky book club on Twitter.
What's your top tip to your NQTs during COVID?
Make sure you get enough sleep.
Okay, your own well-being advice to yourself?
Have Sundays off, always. Never say yes to something on a Sunday.
That's a good one, I like that. I use Saturdays. Piece of advice for a teacher curious about research?
I would say get yourself onto Research Ed Home as a starting point. That's an interesting look. Also, have a look at what learning scientists are doing, because that's probably going to be integral to your practice.
Yeah, they're very, very good. What's your biggest or most proud achievement?
Writing 2 books in a year.
Yeah,
ridiculous.
I was going to say, what's your secret? I struggle to get one out every couple of years.
My children don't sleep, so.
What is your secret? There's the question. What's your secret?
not sleeping. So.
Okay. Now, I'm assuming teaching is your dream job, but what is that off the wall curveball career that you would have loved to have done?
I would like to. I'd really wish that I'd learned piano. We had to get rid of our piano a couple of years ago, and I didn't get around to teaching myself properly. So yeah, that would be the dream.
Okay, who would you who would you recommend I interview next, and why?
Oh, that's so hard. I would say that you should interview Dave Goodwin, because just for the fact that he is so northern, I could listen to him talk about practically anything. However, his knowledge on graphic organizers is out of this world. So right. I find him really interesting to listen to.
I'll hunt him down. Okay, where can listeners find out more about you and, you know, connect online?
I am at Sesmis on Twitter. I also blog at sesmis.wordpress.com, and I flit about doing stuff with Litdrive, so you can find that at Litdrive UK or www.litdrive.org.
And my final question, Kat, is what do you hope to be your legacy?
People not leaving teaching would be really nice. That makes me really sad. So that would make my day.
That would be a really interesting one. I'd be curious to know how many people are still in the classroom when I qualified, actually. But as we all know, the attrition rate is pretty shocking, isn't it? One question I didn't ask is, how many years have you
people that send a DM saying,
how many years have you put into the classroom yourself?
I'm on my 8th, I think. Yeah.
Okay, so you get into the itch. The average lifespan of teachers in England is 13 years. So fingers crossed. But
I'm not done.
Thank you for your time. It's been a real pleasure to chat with you. I can't wait to find out more about your new book, Symbiosis. That is a very fascinating description of how it all connects together. And for people listening, Stop Talking About Wellbeing, it's a fantastic book, really informed some of my thinking in terms of teacher workload and wellbeing. And I wish you all the best, Kat. I look forward to the third book.
Lovely. Well, no. Take care.
Okay, take care.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.